possible to control copying on general purpose computers and the internet. And second, that unless they can do this, the entertainment industry is doomed. So we have a long track record, a lot of evidence about the likelihood that controlling copying is possible. And nowhere do we have more evidence about this than here in Norway, where we've seen exactly what happens when you take the smartest people in the studios, the smartest people in the consumer electronics companies, and you put them in a room for several years and have them design a fiendishly clever anti-copying scheme for DVDs and deploy it on millions of units. What happens is 15-year-olds break it before breakfast for fun. There's a technical reason this happens. It's not because those people are dumb, and they absolutely aren't. I have served on many standards committees, both in Europe and North America, with engineers who work for DRM vendors, and for which is digital rights management, anti-copying vendors, and for the studios. And there's not a one of them I would describe as stupid. They're all of them very, very clever. But it's because they've embarked on what amounts to a fool's errand. So a little primer here on cryptography, and I'll keep it short because I think some of you have heard me do this before. Cryptography involves taking a bunch of secrets and combining them in certain ways to reveal the text, to reveal the clear text. So the way that it normally works is you have a clear text, the original message, say it's a film or a piece of music or even an email. And then you have an algorithm whereby you transform that into something that's indistinguishable from random noise. And the algorithm uses both the original clear text and a secret key, and it combines them both to make this noise. And then you recombine it with the key to turn it back into the original message. Now this works really well, provided that you trust the person who has the key. So we can do really useful things with email, for example, where we can exchange keys and I can send you an email that's encrypted, and we can be really certain that no one will ever be able to decrypt it. These algorithms that we use to encrypt messages, they're provably very strong. There's a global and well-established scientific and mathematical consensus that encryption standards like AES, for example, are extremely strong. And when I say extremely strong, I mean to say that if we took all the computers that have ever been created and all the computers that are likely to be created for the next 100 years and put them to nothing but decrypting an email for the next trillion years, that's how long it would take them to do it. So the algorithms are very, very good. The problem is, the problem occurs when you send someone who you don't trust the secret. And in DRM contexts, in copy protection contexts, the person who owns the media, the person who buys the DVD, the person who buys the music, the person who buys the game, is not trusted. If they were trusted, you wouldn't need anti-copying stuff. You just say, I trust you, please don't copy this. So that person is not trusted, and that person can't be given the key. If that person comes in contact with the key, if that person can get the key, then that person can decrypt the encrypted game, the encrypted music, the encrypted book, the encrypted song. And that person can then freely copy it, make as many copies as he or she would like. Now, the problem with this is that people won't buy DVDs and books and games and other media unless they can decrypt them. So if I sell you a DVD of Star Wars Episode 1, and I don't provide you with a means of actually decrypting it so that you can watch it, you may count it as a small mercy. But in fact, I think most people would pay rather less for a DVD of Star Wars Episode 1 that they couldn't watch than one that they could. And so we need to have a means whereby we deliver the key to the user, but we ensure that the user never gets to actually touch or hold the key. Now, in practice, this turns out to be incredibly hard. I would say that it's unsolvably hard, because what this amounts to, say with DVDs, is shipping out millions and millions of devices to people who all of them get the device in their living room and have any resource they want that they can bring to bear on that device to try and find where the key has been hidden. And not every one of those people has to be incredibly clever. Just one of those people has to be incredibly clever to extract the key. And once that person has extracted the key, that key can be widely distributed, and then there's really not much you can do about it. So to give you an example of how amazingly hard it is to keep a key from people and how amazingly easy it is to discover that key, we have two competing standards for high-definition DVDs. One was DVD-HD, which you now know is defunct, and the other one was Blu-ray, which is still a going concern. And a guy who goes by Muselix64, an adversary so formidable he named himself after a breakfast cereal, decided that he was going to attack DVD-HD. So he spent some time looking at a DVD-HD, and he did it for exactly the same reason that your Jan like Johansson did. He had bought some DVD-HDs and he couldn't play them. And he said, well, obviously I expected that I would be able to play these on my device of choosing, and I can't, and I just want to watch my discs, and I'm going to break the DRM on this so that I can watch my discs. So he did. He found the key, he extracted it, and it turned out that all he needed to do was find the company that had done the worst job of hiding the key. Because you don't have to find the key that's best defended, you can find any of the keys. And so when you have something like a DVD player, and you can imagine there are all these little manufacturers, they pop up in Guangzhou and Shenzhen and Taiwan and Malaysia and so on, and you know, some of them are like two guys in a garage. And you say to them, well, if you don't hide the key properly, we'll fine you $500,000 a month, or whatever the license agreement provides for. They're like, $500,000 a month, next month I'm going to be in a different business, I don't care, right? So they find the person who's hidden the key the worst, and they publish it widely, and the secret's out. It can't be put back in. As my friend John Perry Barlow says, it's very easy to put some food coloring in a swimming pool, it's a lot harder to remove it. And so this 64-bit number, I think it was, or maybe it's 128-bit number, is floating around on the internet. There were the day that the licensing authority that controls the key started to send out notices to people saying, you have to stop publishing this number. I Googled it to see how many instances of the number I could find. There were 300,000. The next day when the news story hit that they were trying to suppress this number, there were 2 million. And then there were like 5 million, and now it's just sort of irredeemably lost. It's as immortal as Paris Hilton's genitals. You'll never erase them. So Muselix64 had broken the DVD, and he was fine. And he liked the intellectual challenge, because like many young people, he's cash poor and time rich and enjoys an intellectual challenge. And along came another forum reader in the forum that Muselix64 hung out in, and he said, I've got a Blu-ray disc, and I've got exactly the same problem. Can you help me? He said, well, I've never actually seen or touched or held a Blu-ray disc or a Blu-ray player, but yeah, I think I can break it. I'll tell you what, you put a Blu-ray disc in your computer, and then you send me the contents of memory, right? Just a RAM dump of the 2 gigs of memory you've got in your computer. Just save your memory off to the hard drive, zip it up, and email it to me. Because somewhere in that memory is the key, right? If you're playing the disc, the key's got to be there. And so what he did was he took the first 128 bits of memory, And then he tried to decrypt the video that he could see later on in the memory, and it wasn't there. Then he took bit 2 through 129, and then 3 through 130, and about half an hour later, he had undone the work of years of and millions of dollars worth of research, the greatest minds the copy protection companies had to offer, completely unraveled it, because he was an infinitely resourced attacker, and once he broken it once, it broke everywhere. And that was the end of it. And so Blu-ray's still around, and of course this should give us some reason to question whether the claim that the ability to control copies is a necessary precondition for the good orderly functioning of the entertainment industry, because of course Blu-ray's now been broken for quite some time. But the more important object lesson here is that it just doesn't work. As a practical matter, there's never been one of these systems that guarded anything anyone cared about that didn't break. The exception is when it turned out to be easier not to break it. So for example, with music, it's often easier just to record the music back again without even having to play it out through the speakers, because of course, one of the things that's true about games and books and all the rest of it is that unless you can make it intelligible to the human sensory apparatus, that is, unless you can turn the video back into a picture, the audio back into sound, unless you can turn the words back into words, no one will buy it. Well, once the audio has been turned back into audio, you can just tell your computer, instead of playing this audio back through the speakers, play it to my hard drive in the clear, please. Instead of playing this video through the speaker, through the screen, just play it to my hard drive. And of course, the problem of converting text to text has been solved for as long as there have been typists who could take dictation. So that's one extraordinary claim. The next extraordinary claim is that unless we can deploy automated copyright infringement detection software, the entertainment industry is dead, and furthermore, that it's possible to do so. So we see this claim in respect of things like YouTube, where the entertainment industry has claimed repeatedly that the reason that YouTube doesn't stop people from uploading infringing material is because they're getting too much benefit from it, and not because automatically detecting infringing material is transcendently difficult. But I put it to you that it is. So let's take a much easier problem to solve, spam. Right? Spam is a very easy problem to solve because it's almost all text, and the people who receive it don't want it, and they'll happily collaborate with you to help you get rid of it. And yet, we have come nowhere near solving spam. If it were possible to detect copyright infringement with software, you could do so many more interesting things with your fully functional artificial intelligence than detecting copyright infringement that Google wouldn't need to be in the YouTube business. They could be in the business of replacing humanity and everything we do with strong AI business. And this is in fact why we don't have good copyright infringement detection software. What we have instead is very bad copyright infringement detection software. Software that can't tell the difference between an artist's own composition and one that's infringing. Software that can't tell between a use that's fair and a use that's not. Software that just makes mistakes and that automatically enforces it with the blind robotic stupidity of a machine stamping press that you've stuck your hand in. So another extraordinary term, another extraordinary claim is that longer terms of copyright are not only good for artists but are necessary for artists. And there are two things that are extraordinary about this claim. The first is that artists end up being the primary beneficiary of longer terms of copyright. And in fact, what we've seen historically, whenever copyright has been expanded or whenever the rights have been lengthened, that the people who have negotiating power over artists have arrogated those rights to themselves. They've just taken them away. If you ever study martial arts, you'll find that one of the first pieces of advice that they'll give you is any weapon you don't know how to use belongs to your attacker. And if the European Parliament, as it's been debating, gives artists another 45 years of copyright in their sound recordings, the first thing that will happen is that the contracts will be amended to say that the record labels will get the full 95 years of copyright in those sound recordings, because that's the way the contracts read today. It's a full grant of rights to those artists, or to those labels rather, excuse me. And so that's the first problem. The second problem is what this does to working artists. So what it ends up doing is locking up all the work of all the artists whom anyone knows anything about, all the ones that we can remember, which means that if you're an artist who's creating something that follows on from one of your contemporaries or from some of the music that has been part of the acoustic vocabulary of the people in your society, that your access to those works is limited to your ability to strike deals with those large rights holders. Those, not the individual artists, but the people who control huge pools of copyrights. So today, we can see how this plays out. If you're an artist who wants to do a lot of sampling in your music, and you work for one of the four major record labels, and you need to clear some samples. Well, first of all, there's a 1 in 4 chance that the sample you need to clear is in your own label's catalog, because there's only 4 of them. But second of all, if it's not in your label's catalog, they all have very cozy relationships with each other. Your label's lawyer can call up another label's lawyer and say, hey Fred, do you remember last week when I licensed some of my artist samples to you? I'm just gonna send that contract back over again. I'm gonna scratch out my name and put your name in, and your name and put my name in, because we need to license some samples back for us. It's a very cozy relationship if you're willing to sign the incredibly abusive contracts that characterize a deal that an artist has with a label. Now, if you want to strike out on your own, you're completely in the cold, because the term of copyright means that practically anything you might want to sample is controlled by one of these 4 companies. And what that means at the end of the day is that unless you take the abusive deal, you're stuck. So, the last extraordinary claim I want to talk about here is the claim that without extrajudicial powers to disconnect people from the internet, the entertainment industry can't survive, and that ultimately this will be good for culture and society. So you may have heard about this in France. They called it the Hadopi proposal. In the UK, they call it graduated enforcement. At the World Intellectual Property Organization, when they first floated this idea, they called it notice and termination. And you sometimes hear it called the 3 strikes rule. And the way that this rule works in one or another permutation is something like this. If you're accused of copyright infringement 3 times, you lose your network connection. Now, not proven to have infringed copyright even once, let alone 3 times, but merely accused. Now, sometimes there's a judicial process. In France, the initial version of this bill was bounced by the Constitutional Court, who said, you can't take people off the internet without showing some evidence and giving them a chance to defend themselves in front of a court. And so Sarkozy's regime countered with a special kind of kangaroo court that hears these cases in 3-minute increments. So you have sort of 3 minutes to present your case, and if it turns out that you don't make your case, you lose your network connection. Let's talk about what we do on the internet. So I once spent a week noting all the things I did on the internet. And after the first 48 hours, I couldn't believe the list. I had looked up health information. I have a little 19-month-old daughter at home. And as babies do, she got a cold. And as babies' immune systems do, it went crazy. So she broke out in little red spots all over. And we live in Hackney, where there's a bunch of crazy people who don't inoculate their babies. So there's measles in Hackney. And so I thought, oh my god, my daughter has measles. And so the first thing I did was went online and found the NHS's website and reassured myself that my daughter didn't have measles. Later that day, I called my family in Canada and told them that my daughter didn't have measles because they were quite worried. And then the next day, I found myself talking to my member of European Parliament and my member of Parliament and consulting on a European Parliament consultation, or rather European Commission consultation. So I was engaged in civic activities. So we've got health, we've got family, we've got civic activity. Of course, I earn about 98% of my living from the internet, so I was also earning my living. I was also doing things like looking up maps to find out how to get around the city I live in. I was looking up the rules and regulations for where I put my rubbish. I was teaching students. I have remote students both in the UK and in Canada whom I instruct. And on and on and on. The list just didn't end. So the network turns out not to be just a better tool for getting MP3s. It turns out to be the way that we do freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, participation in civic and public life, get our health information, get our education, stay in touch with our families, stay in touch with our friends, fall in love, conduct our romances. All of this is on the network. And on the basis of 3 accusations of copyright infringement, we are proposing to take that away, not from the person who's accused, but from the entire household of the person who's accused. And in fact, my network connection, because British Telecom has an arrangement with the Spanish mobile Wi-Fi sharing company, Fun, so that I can share my network connection with my neighbors who share it with me. There are 9 people who use my network connection, all of whom, on the basis of this, would lose their, on the basis of an accusation, would lose their network connection. We have a name for that. We call it collective punishment. And it is not a feature of a liberal democracy. It is, in fact, characteristic of tyranny. So that's one of the problems here, is that the network is valuable for so much more. And of course, there's no proposal to have this go in the other direction. No one is saying that if Universal Music makes 3 bad copyright infringement accusations, that we can go to Universal Music's offices and disconnect their internet connections. And yet we know from the record that when we have given self-help powers to any industry, but particularly to the entertainment industry, that their use of those powers has been very sloppy. In fact, what the entertainment industry around the world has done is outsourced enforcement of copyright to firms who have an incentive to file more claims. They get paid on the basis of the number of claims that they make. And what they do is they make lots and lots of claims, including in the US, we've had a claim that a laser printer was downloading a copy of the Indiana Jones movie. We've had claims against dead people. We've had claims against people who didn't own computers. We've had claims against, there was a claim that a sweet old grandmother in Florida had been downloading gangster rap, and so on and so forth. Now, the answer is that when these people, if they can find someone who can, who will step forward for them and represent them and say, no, I'm not infringing, and make a clear case that it's going to happen, then they back off. They say, oh, well, you know, we'll walk away from this. But normally what they do is they say, actually, we're going to price the settlement for this claim at just a little below what it will cost you to find out whether from a lawyer whether or not you should pay it. We have a word for that, too. We call it a protection racket. And it's, again, not a feature of an industry. It's a feature of a crime syndicate. So giving these self-help powers to any industry, let alone an industry with such a poor track record, seems to me to be a bad bargain. But it's a worse bargain still, because I think we all infringe copyright all the time. I think that copyright law has failed to keep abreast of what we do on a daily basis. So I give talks like this everywhere. One of the questions I always ask, and I'll ask it of you in a minute, is who in this room is not an infringer? Now let me give you some, before I ask this question, let me give you some examples. So my friend Kirby Dick made a movie called This Film Is Not Yet Rated. It's a movie about how the Motion Picture Association of America puts ratings on movies. They have a secret ratings board whose identities are kept secret, the criteria they use are kept secret. And he thought that there was something fishy about it. He thought that they weren't who they said they were. They said they were all young parents. And he thought, no, they're not young parents. They're studio executives. I know who these people are. So he hired a private detective to follow them around and to figure out who they were. And he made a movie about it, and he submitted it to the ratings board. Very funny stuff, right? So he submitted it to the ratings board, and that's the first half of the movie. The second half of the movie is what happens after he submitted it. And the first thing that happens after he submits it is he gets a call from the head of the Motion Picture Association of America in Washington, D.C. He says, Kirby, I've just seen your movie. Kirby says, that's interesting, because as far as I know, my movie is in Los Angeles. How did you see it? He said, oh, they made a copy for me. So I didn't authorize you making a copy. And he said, oh, don't worry, it's in my vault. It's in my safe, it's in my vault. So I think this should be our defense from now on. I did download those movies, but I put them in a vault. So I gave a talk like this to the Imagineering department at Disney in Burbank. I'm a huge Disney theme park fan. And those of you who read my novels know my first novel is about a future Walt Disney World takeover. I'm a nut for Disney. I'm going this Christmas. I'm going to give a talk to their social media group. My first date with my wife was a weekend in Disneyland. So I'm a big Disney fan. So I found myself talking to the Disney engineers. And of course, when you announce that you're going to give a talk like this at Disney, the lawyers want to come too. So it's sort of half engineers, half lawyers. And I said, who in this room is not a copyright infringer? And a couple of the engineers started to do this. The copyright lawyers didn't. And they looked over at those engineers and they went, put your hand down. Because at the end of the day, we all end up infringing copyright because the rules of copyright are really intended to regulate the interactions between corporate entities and sometimes professional management agents and lawyers for creative people. They're very poorly suited to negotiating the relationships between individuals or between individuals and artists. They don't work very well. It's just like the banking rules are supposed to regulate what banks do, although they don't do a very good job of it, as it turns out. But they'd be very poorly suited to regulating what you do. You know, if you wanted to take a friend out for lunch and you loan them 50 kroner, you wouldn't expect to have to file a disclosure form with the financial regulator. But if you're a 12-year-old who wants to make a Harry Potter fan fiction story and make sure you're on the right side of the law, you have to somehow convince a lawyer at Warner Brothers to negotiate a contract with you for the license. And this is not only implausible, it's impossible. And so we all end up infringing. And so with that, I'm going to ask you, who in this room is not a copyright infringer? So that's the danger. And no one put their hand up. That's the danger. Is that when you say that people who are copyright infringers can, without judicial intervention, without the intervention of common sense that says, this is de minimis. This is below the notice of the law. This is outside the intention of the law. This harms no one. This is a legitimate part of cultural participation. Without that, when we leave it to a self-interested industry to regulate who can participate in the information society, we are all of us vulnerable to the capricious enforcement of these self-help measures. And my last example of that is going to be the lawsuit the Recording Industry Association of America brought against a student at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania in America, this student was a computer science student, and he was maintaining a search engine software, a program called Flatlan, L-A-N, Flatlan, and it was a search engine that searched the local area network, hence Flatlan. It was free and open source software, so he'd taken over maintenance of it. And what it would do is it would crawl your local area network and tell you about all the publicly shared files, just like Google has a crawler that crawls the web and shows you all the publicly shared HTML files and PDFs and so on. And so on a campus network, you had, you know, the profs' course notes and their PowerPoints and the MP3s of their lectures. But of course, it was a campus network, so you also had movies and you had music and you had crack video games and everything else that students trade, because students are quite active infringers. And so they went after this kid. They didn't go after him for keeping a search engine, for writing a search engine, because that's not illegal. They went after him for sharing music. Well, how did they know he was sharing music? They knew he was sharing music because he was an American male below the age of 30. And so when they found that he'd been sharing music, they said to him, here's the settlement we're going to offer you. Your life savings, and you change majors. We don't want you programming computers anymore. So when we are all presumptively guilty, now it has a happy ending because it was so obnoxious that we were able to call so much attention to it that they backed off from it. But this is the danger, right? When we are all guilty of something, It means that you are liable to capricious enforcement from people who don't enforce in the public interest, who don't think about common sense, but who are instead limited and parochial in their interest in trying to defend their little patch of turf. So I say that these claims, these extraordinary claims, are wrong. I say that it's possible to enjoy a healthy artistic living from a more liberal copyright regime. And I'm not a copyright abolitionist, but I am a copyright liberalizer. So this book here, which I eventually have to talk about, thank you, is Little Brother. It's in 17 languages now, 90-something thousand US hardcovers, sold the film rights, sold the play. The play is now being produced in like 12 American cities. Sold the radio play. Just sold the graphic novel rights. And I've had a lot of other ancillary income off the back of it. It has been a commercial, it was a New York Times bestseller. It's won about 30 different important prizes, both for young adult literature and for science fiction, and for lots of other things. It's done incredibly well. It was available as a free download the day it appeared in stores, like all my books. And it was available as a download that encouraged you to share it and remix it. And a number of the foreign deals that I've gotten from foreign publishers have been to buy the rights to produce a commercial translation in a market where fans had already produced a non-commercial translation. And those publishers look at those non-commercial translations and say, 90,000 downloads? That means that there's a lot of people who'd like to buy the book. And so you, in fact, can compete with free even when free is yourself. And that's the commercial case. You know, my problem isn't piracy, it's obscurity. This is what Tim O'Reilly, the founder of the largest tech book publisher in the world, says. But it's not just a commercial case. It's also an artistic case, because we live now in the 21st century, and copying will not get harder this century. Hard drives are not going to get bulkier and more expensive. They won't hold fewer bits. Networks aren't going to get harder to use or slower or more expensive. And every day, more people are going to go to job retraining schemes at the local library and the community center, in which they're going to be taught to go to Google and type in Batman Torrent. So copying is never going to get harder. And if you are making art that isn't intended to be copied, it may be good art, but it won't be contemporary art. In the sense that it won't have come to grips with the dominant technology of the 21st century. It may be lovely. I had a neighbor when I lived in Toronto. I lived in this beautiful warehouse, and all my neighbors were artists. My neighbor painted reproductions of Dutch masters, and he made his own gesso for rabbits and egg whites, and it was quite fantastic and retro. It wasn't contemporary. Right? And yes, there's something lovely and sweet about being a blacksmith at a pioneer village, but it's not contemporary art. And artistically, I find it incredibly satisfying to be engaged with the dominant ethos and technology of our age. And then finally, I want to talk about the moral case, because I'm a copier. You guys are all copiers. I've always been a copier. I think we're born copiers. When my daughter was born, my parents came to visit. My mother has a PhD in early childhood education. She's very good with babies. And my daughter was about a week old. She was, you know, an incredibly adorable, heartbreaking blob. She had yet to do anything apart from feed and poo and break our hearts. And my mother said, "Have you stuck your tongue out at the baby yet?" I said, "Have I done what?" She said, "Have you stuck your tongue out at her?" I said, "No, I haven't stuck my tongue out at my daughter. Why would I?" And she said, "Watch this." And she took my daughter in her arms, and she went, and my daughter looked up at her and went, my daughter hadn't seen a mirror yet. She didn't know she had a tongue. How amazing is that? We copy from the moment we come out of the womb. Copying is what we are. Copying is what we do. If it wasn't for mixtapes, my entire adolescence would have been celibate. If I was 17 years old, I would be copying my books. And so for me to turn around to these people and say, "It's okay, my copies are in a vault, your copies are infringing," just to me reeks of the worst kind of hypocrisy. And I go to bed feeling great every night, because I know that I'm not telling my readers that they should be ashamed of something that I do all day long. So if the entertainment industry is right, and I don't think they are, but if it's true that unless they can control copying, unless they can control who gets access to the network, unless they can impose penalties, unless they can get longer terms of copyright, unless they can reduce the diversity of participation and culture and make all of our participation in civil society subject to the whims of a few industrial players, that they won't survive. And the choice is all of those benefits we've gotten from the information age or the movie industry, I choose the information age. And I think that if there's one tactical mistake the entertainment industry has made, it's in continually drawing this ultimatum to say, no one will make movies or music or art anymore if we can't control this and that and the other. Well, it's first of all visibly untrue, because until the 17th century there wasn't anything like copyright, and of course people made some pretty interesting things before the 17th century. But second of all, if it's true, I know which one I choose. And I think most of us would choose the same way if we were really put to it. So thank you.
File sharing, copyright, privacy, and the future of culture, like Cora just covered in his talk. I'm Martin Gunnar Lawson. I work for the book section of Klasse Kampen. I'd like to introduce the panel. Sitting next to me is Bjarne Buseth. He's head of information and public relations at the Gyldendal Publishing House. He's been spearheading this campaign, which has been running in the media lately, called Dele ikke stjele, Share Don't Steal. He's a vocal supporter of creators' rights and an opponent of piracy. He's argued in favor of DRM, digital rights management. Next to him is Bente Kausnes. She works as an information consultant for the social media site Origo. She has a background in journalism and an MA in communication, culture, and technology from Georgetown University. She's been a frequent commenter on social and political issues relating to technology. Next to her is Eric Newt. He is a freelance astrophysicist working as a popularizer of the natural sciences, as a lecturer and writer. Like Bente, he's also a commenter on technological issues, and he's been sort of central to the last couple of file sharing debates. All of our panelists are immersed in social media. They are on Twitter, they're bloggers, they're Flickerers, and you can follow them in all sorts of forums. What's going to happen now is I'm going to give each member of our panel just like a minute and a half to place themselves in relation to Corey's talk and to the issues at hand. And then we could go on to questions, and at the end of the question session, debate session, I'm going to give you guys a chance to ask questions as well. All right, John.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to congratulate you, Corey, on your book. Okay. It's a great book. I haven't read all of it yet. I'm halfway into it. I enjoy it very much. It's a great plot. It's great suspense, superb humor. And it's eminently paranoid. I'll get back to that. I must also congratulate you. Well, I've been asked by our moderator to say a few words about my view on three main topics, I think: file sharing, privacy, and digital rights management. Unfortunately, he gave up my position on the last topic, but then I can try to do something about the two first. I must also congratulate you on your file sharing strategy for boosting the paper books, which I think is very, almost have to say it's almost sexy. And this brings me directly to the first topic, file sharing, where I think you, as a technology optimist, you underestimate a bit the technologic development. I think that this file sharing strategy will be smart for some authors in some situations, especially in a period of technological transition like we're going through at the moment. An unknown author can make herself known this way, or she can introduce a new character to the audience. Things like that. But I don't think that this is a strategy that's good for every writer in every situation forever. I think you underestimate the effect that will strike the book business the moment people understand that it's quite okay to read from screen. And I also think at the same time that you underestimate the transition that Marx called from quantity to quality that's going on here. You say in your book that loaning books has been around longer than any publisher on earth, and it's a fine thing. And nobody denies the fact that libraries are a fine thing. But if the whole book industry turns digital and the library can loan books to every citizen, then I think it would be rather stupid to buy one. So if a writer should be able to make money, you'd have to reinvent copyright in some way or other. But that's a big question, of course. I think the book industry can make strategies that don't make a competition between the digital book and the paper book, and that's maybe what you are advocating. So I won't make necessarily an opposition between these two things. But I think what's going on with Kindle and Barnes & Noble for the moment in America is a kind of price war that has a tendency to make people give up on the paper books, and I don't think that's necessary. Well, that's for the file sharing. I'm using too much time, am I?
Yeah, but
I'll go fast on the privacy part then.
We can come back to it in the discussion.
Yes, but short on privacy then. This is what I think. Your descriptions of our society and the dangers to privacy, I think, are overestimated. But I would say I plan to make a point. I think it takes too long time about that you're not paranoid enough, because I can't understand how this should be a problem only for people who want to keep copyright as a mechanism also in the digital world. I can't understand why we are not everyone in the same boat in this question, that we need to solve this somehow. And then the last question we can come back to, but just like to say that I don't know if we disagree on any of those two first points, in fact, because you also said you're not a copyright abolitionist, so then I think we will be in the end agree on the fact that we need it still. But then, luckily, since I don't know if you disagree on the first two topics, let's thank God for the four-letter word DRM, because there we can probably have a quorum afterwards.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for inviting me to this event. I've been so lucky that I've heard Cory Doctorow before. That was at the Republika in Berlin this spring. And then you talked about a couple of lots of interesting things, but you used two very interesting images. You said that the internet is the most perfect copying machine we've ever seen. And you also said that it's the best collaborative machine we've ever built. And I think it's very important to have these two images in your head when we're talking about these issues, because especially when it comes to solution, I think the collaborative part is going to be part of the solution when it comes to file sharing. I work at Origo.no, which is an online community, but it's also a publishing system. And that is all about sharing. It's about sharing content, it's sharing images, calendars, friends, communities. I'm not very much into the illegal file sharing culture myself. I'm not a user of Pirate Bay, but I'm mostly paying for the music I'm listening to at iTunes, or I use Spotify. But still, I'm very concerned about the whole culture around piracy and file sharing, and I'm also very concerned about the way the big companies have tried to attack this issue. And I'm concerned that the publishing companies are going to repeat the same mistakes as we've seen in the music companies and the film companies. I'm also very concerned that because the film companies and music companies have been attacking the customers so hard, to make they made their customers their worst enemies, and criminalizing a whole generation. I hope we're not going to see the same mistakes within the publishing companies. And I'm also concerned that the cultural producers, the companies that are surrounding them, and also politicians have spent the time since 1999 and Napster so inefficiently. They haven't been able to find a good business model or a good technical solution for this issue. Because these days we want to listen to your favorite music, your favorite movies, and we want to do it at the same time as the Americans do or the Japanese do. We want to be part of the same discussions. We don't want to come in and watch Mad Men 1 month later or 6 months later. We don't want to have this tyranny of distance in 2009. We don't have to do that. But as all of us know, because there's all these legal issues, we still have to wait. And I think that's part of the problem with piracy, because we won't have the cultural content immediately, and we can't access it immediately, then we get piracy. So the way I see it, as a previous journalist and now working for Origo, there's three things we need to do. And maybe Spotify is part of the solution to all this, I don't know yet, but we have to make it as easy as possible to buy legally music and films, literature, games, images, software. And that is the only way we can compete with piracy. And the law has to make sure that amateurs and private users has the possibility to remix and change the digital copy without being sued to the highest court. And the third point is that I think the artist should be able to earn money on the art they produce. I mean, this is three maybe impossible wishes, but I think that's three very important points. And now I think it's very important to speed up the process to try to find a solution. And I'm glad that finally some of the political parties in Norway have started talking about this. We know that Venstre, the Progressive Party, the Socialist Left, SV, and Rødt, they've started talking about different kind of solutions. But I think we have to engage everyone, not just the politicians, but the artists, the publishing companies, the programmers. And I think we need to find a collaborative solution. I don't think we can only trust the industry to solve this for us.
Yeah, long minutes and a half, this is okay.
Okay. Of course, I could make it very easy on everyone and said, okay, Corey made all my points for me, so that's it. But okay, I actually read his book about an hour after. I started reading it an hour after he had put it out on his website. I read it for free, and ever since I read it, I've spent my time promoting his book and blogging about it, so I'm supporting his business model in that way. There were some good points made here. I'm mostly concerned with the fact that we are on the eve of an election, and I'm pretty certain that in the next parliamentary period, the next 4 years, a decision will be made. A decision will be made in Norway as to how to start solving this problem, because I acknowledge that it's a problem. We have to do something, and I agree with Bente. We need to find some sort of Scandinavian solution, which means that we need a compromise. Everybody needs to sit down. They need to calm down, lower the blood pressure, and sort of quieten the rhetoric, and find a model. As for me, I've proposed a model, sort of like a three-step model, which first, you need to do something about the environment for businesses that work with digital content, because that's not ideal, to say the least. For instance, we have VAT on e-books in Norway, and we don't have any VAT on paper books. That's idiotic.
That's so, mums.
Sorry. and there are many other areas where we can make things better for people who actually want to earn money on digital content. The second thing is that we do need some sort of government-funded compensation scheme. We probably do. We have it for paper copying, we have it for music, we will sooner or later have to sit down and say, okay, let's assume that there are losses, And I accept that people lose money because of illegal file sharing. Let's see how we can compensate that. That's the way we do it in our part of the world. The third thing is we need to do something. We might need to do something about the laws. We might need copyright. Might need copyright revision. I'm not an abolitionist myself, but we need to look at the law again to see if it works in this day and age. Because, as Corey very well pointed out, we are all criminals. And as it has been said that we there's no reason to change the law if many people break it. No, but if everybody breaks it, we have a problem. One of the problems is that how do you put together a jury consisting of people who have probably broken the same laws? This is not trivial. In 2 days, I'm going to talk to Økokrim, which is the economic police in Norway. And I have to tell them the same thing. You are probably criminals yourself. You've broken the same law. So how do you investigate this, knowing that you have probably broken the same law? So yeah, in its current form, the law doesn't work very well. But none of this is going to move forward unless we address the problem of privacy and the problem of the right to a fair trial, which is the basic civil rights that Corey talked about. And an interesting thing has happened in Norway, because most parties didn't want to talk about this. They they ran away from the question. But in the last half year, thanks to the Progressive Party and the Socialist Left and the Red Party, this issue has been brought to the forefront. And just 10 days ago, I chaired a debate in which we had 7 Norwegian parties, and 6 of them were adamant. They don't want a Swedish IPRE law, which is a surveillance law. They don't want a French Hadopi law. They don't want mass lawsuits against young people like the ones Corey mentioned. So actually, a majority of the parties that are going to sit in the parliament after the election have already pledged that they don't want this. Our main problem now is that there are 2 big parties, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, and they haven't said what they want yet. They're actually silent on this matter. And my main criticism at the moment is not people that disagree with me. I'm fine with if people want an IPRE law, well, go ahead and say it. My main problem is with all the people who at the moment are keeping quiet. They're not saying anything, because this is not quantum science. Actually, it's quite easy to determine. Are you for mass surveillance of every Norwegian, or are you against? Are you for mass lawsuits against young people? Okay, that's fine, but say that you are for them, or say that you are against them. This is not hard to do. And I can assure you one thing. In the next 4 years, the people who keep quiet about this are going to be left out of the debate, because you have to address the problem of civil rights. That's why 1.5 minutes.
I have actual 90 seconds here.
Excellent.
Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe even fewer. So one of the things that I think is important to acknowledge here is that the solution won't work for everyone, and technology giveth and technology taketh away, and the radio destroyed the careers of many important vaudeville artists, and I shouldn't have to tell you here in the heart of Lutheran country that the printing press had quite a dramatic impact on a lot of people whose livelihood depended on the exclusive right to produce one rather important book. And nor will any of this work forever. In fact, we are not in a period of technological transition. We are in a period of permanent transition. And the idea that we will come up with a model that works forever is just as wrong as the idea that the current model can continue to hold. Thanks.
So, all right, I want to steer the debate back to privacy and the legal issues in a moment, but I think, I look at the audience and I see a lot of creative people out there, people who are working as writers, as songwriters, musicians, composers, and people who work in the publishing industry as well. I think the question that's sort of burning a hole in everybody's head right now is, how do we continue to have a situation in which we can get paid, and in which there is an editorial process in which there's an enrichment process of the cultural products. There's editing, producing these infrastructures around the works of art. So I'd like to start with you, Corey. What do you see? How do you see these businesses managing in the future?
Well, so I don't care about the individual businesses, or even necessarily an individual artist. I care that there are artists and businesses. Who cares that the Edison's Trust is still a going concern 50 years later, right? But here's one thing that I think is true about the era that we live in, is that the crashing cost of making a copy of a commodity, that is, of information, has vastly elevated the cost of the non-commodity component, that is, the non-readily reproducible thing, like a concert. So there's a reason Madonna no longer has a record label, she has a concert promoter, and that's because the fact that the more copies there are of Madonna's music out there in the world, in giving people pleasure, the hotter the auction will be for the tickets to her shows. And so that's very true. I had dinner last night with a musician named Amanda Palmer, who was explaining to me that she signs everything when she leaves the dressing room. She signs the napkins, she signs the mirror, she signs it all. It all gets auctioned off. And that's you know, there are the veneration of the object is more important than it's ever been, and our capacity to build totemistic objects is more important than it's ever been. I'm on the board of a charity that oversees a program called Clarion that teaches science fiction writing to young writers. And our fundraiser this year, we're going to solicit 101 keyboards, old keyboards from 101 well-known science fiction writers, along with the bibliography of all the books ever written on them. And we're going to take one key off of each of them. We're going to build a beautiful steampunk keyboard off of it. We're going to hand bind a book that explains all the books that have been written with the keys on this keyboard, and we're going to auction it off, and I think we're going to get $50,000 for it. Right? We inhabit an era in which the physical object has more value than it ever has before, if it's the right physical object, and that's the paradox of the infinitely reproducible information.
But Bjarne, how do you see the threats to your industry? I mean, are you confident that there's going to be an industry if Corey's business model flourishes?
Well, as long as he says he's not an abolitionist of copyright, I think we need copyright also. I think Creative Commons and all that is very useful for the situations when you choose that, but I think we need to make copyright survive into the digital era. And I don't think it's that difficult. We are all lawbreakers, but that's the same thing with the traffic rules. Who in this audience has not broken the speed limits? Raise your hands. Well, and you never burned a red light on your bike?
Ah, well, you talked about the speed limit.
I talked about the traffic rules, and that doesn't mean that we are not able to find a solution to this copyright thing, either without breaking with privacy. I almost said privacy, but privacy. I think it's not that complicated. And but you won't either. You shouldn't force me to say how will I solve this problem, because we can find a solution to this with working together. We can see and well, the bad side of it in Norway for the moment is that there are no signals to people about whether this is a problem or not. The ideology in Norway for the moment is that this is okay. We're not coming after you. We're not going to punish you. We can't do anything about it, and we are probably going to make it legal. Yeah. I think we just need a change in mentality. Just tell people that this is not quite okay. We have to have some kind of system, and then I think most people will apply to that.
Well, we own a lot of DVDs, and when we put some of them into our DVD player, we get a very noisy reminder that it is illegal. You wouldn't steal a car, you wouldn't steal
You know, if you pirate your DVDs, you don't have to watch them.
Yeah, that's right. We need it for the debate. We need to have some clarification on the privacy issue. And this isn't just theoretical, because in our neighbor country, Sweden, they have the most vitriolic debate about file sharing and piracy, because they have a law that allows for mass surveillance and private mass surveillance. And as a result of that, you have the pirate party. And in many ways, what I'm striving for, and in this question, I mean, I regard myself as a moderate. I want some revision, but I believe in copyright, I need copyright. And at the same time, I realize that we're never going to fight this by surveying everybody. We're never going to fight this by forcing people. And we need some sort of consensus. But before we can come to that, we have to sort of remove the threat of copyright to our civil rights. I mean, one of the things that I react to from it, sort of, as you said, it's also a moral question. And as a copyright holder, I react, and I react really negatively when I hear that my intellectual property rights are being used as a weapon towards on millions of people. So in this case, I'm with the French Supreme Court that say that, that basically said that if there's a conflict between intellectual property rights and civil rights take precedence. I agree with that. And I think that we, as creators, as writers, as actors, as musicians, we need to make that clear, because it's not just a political problem, it's an ethical problem. Do you really wish to surveil your neighbor? Do you, is that what you want? Or as the candidate for the Green Party, she's on election tonight, said just 10 days ago, she said something very interesting. She's an archaeologist. So she said, as an archaeologist, I know that culture is copying. And she also said that at creation needs privacy. If you want to create something, you can't have the feeling that somebody's looking over your shoulder. This is not disconnected from my work as a writer. It's part of my work as a writer. I need my privacy. I need to be feel secure in the fact that nobody's watching what I do on the web.
So we've suffered. Oh, I think we heard it.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
First, Corey.
I feel there's a shift when it comes to whether people would like to support artists and pay for the art they're producing. When you go on blogs, or if you go on online forums, if you go to UNESCO, for example, a Norwegian cultural calendar, you see people talking about these things, and I get a sense that people really want to pay for something they like, whether it's a song or a film or a book. But often you can't get hold of the book legally, or you can't get hold of the song legally, or it's too troublesome to pay for it. You have to make an account, or it's way too complicated. So I think it's very important to get good solutions for how to make the culture projects available, and that has been a problem for many of us, that we haven't got hold of them legally, and illegal has been the only solution. So if you can start with making it available and making it possible to pay for it in a very, very easy way, I think that's one step ahead.
And I'd go one step further than that and say that you have to make the commercial product better than the free one, better than the pirate one. I wasn't kidding when I said if you pirate the DVD, you don't have to watch it. I have a 19-month-old. We have Disney DVDs. If you put the Lion King DVD on, it takes 25 minutes to reach the menu to press play of commercials and rubbish and ads for other Disney DVDs and useless animations and so on. 25 minutes. My 19-month-old is not very good at waiting 25 minutes. That's my 30-pound DVD. And, you know, it gets worse than this. We've suffered under a regime in which the record labels, the film studios, and so on, have enjoyed relative anonymity, because with the exception of Disney, no one really knows what record label publisher or film company made the media that they're enjoying. They know the director's name, they know the artist's name, they know the writer's name. And in the case of the labels, it's often a parent company that you don't know about. You know the individual label, not Bertelsmann, for example. And what this has done is given a relative layer of insulation for the people who want to experiment with very draconian measures. So the record labels that put out 7 million CDs that had a rootkit on them. This is a piece of malicious software like those used by virus writers to hijack your computer, and the intention was to stop you copying. And it opened up the door to viruses. It infected American government and military networks. And it really, it was incredibly dangerous software for them to have deployed. But people didn't associate it with the labels. They associated it with the artists whose CDs infected them. And you know, most artists want to be remembered as the guy who wrote the song you lost your virginity to, not the guy who wrote the song you lost your hard drive. And this layer of insulation, we talk about IFP and the RIAA and so on as though they were separate entities. IFP, the RIAA, they're four companies. We know the four record labels, we know who they are, but we talk about them as though when they put on their IFP hats, they're no longer, it's no longer Warner's, it's IFP. But the names in the lawsuits are Warner's. And this has been very dangerous. And the most dangerous thing from the perspective of the long-term health of the labels is that every time you infect someone's computer with malicious software in the name of stopping them copying, they learn the lesson that if they pay for their media, they get infections. If they steal their media, they don't. This is exactly the wrong message to send to people if you want them to grow up to buy media.
I totally agree that we have to get past these stupid solutions, and I'm sorry, I tend to forget about DVDs and things like that because I mostly use online solutions. But I'd like to address the question whether people want to pay or not. I think that's a very dangerous subject, and it's both naive and dangerous to think that if we have a solution which is free, people will choose to pay. For whatever reason should they do that? And I think Spotify is the proof of the pudding. Spotify has been there for a long time, and as far as I know, only 0.7% of the customers have chosen to pay for Spotify. So I think, but I don't think that's a problem for Spotify if there is, if you can stop the free solution or the piracy, because Spotify is so perfectly done that I would have paid immediately if they now said, sorry, we don't make any money, so you have to pay from tomorrow. I would start paying at once. So this is a question of business models, I would say.
Okay. Briefly, Bente, then I.
Yeah, regarding Spotify, I haven't started paying for a premium, but I will after.
Yeah, me too.
After the iPhone application. I think the iPhone application was genius.
Because of course you do on the iPhone. And I will, the day I buy an iPhone, I will pay at once to add Spotify.
Ali?
Well, if nobody else does, okay, I have to mention bottled water. I mean, people actually pay 25 kroners for water that is free from the tap. I did yesterday, but that was because I was very far from a tap where I was out biking. Yeah, people actually do pay for products, even though there are free alternatives. But as Corey says, yeah, it needs to be good. You need to deliver a better product. Now, one of the things that are really annoying, that is really annoying with this debate is it's sort of a binary debate. It's an either-or debate. I mean, we're talking like tomorrow we won't have a single paper book. That's rubbish. Mm. Of course we will. We know this from experience. We know how media evolve. I mean, sometimes old media die, often they don't. So we have parallel with MP3s. We do have CDs. We even have LPs. I mean, they're making a comeback. Not in a big way, but they're there. So yeah, in the future, not everything is going to be ebooks. In my business, we will have paper books. We will have digital textbooks. They will be mostly paid for by the state, so piracy really isn't an issue. We will have free encyclopedias. We will have all kinds of products. And I think the problem with the place we are now, where there's sort of an implied, I mean, a sort of mistrust of the user. And sorry if I read you that way, Bjarne, but you sound like that. You say people are not willing to pay. I mean, that's a really bad starting point if you are going to go on the web. Because sooner or later, you need to have a better web business than you have now, and I think we agree on that. But then you also need to have, I think, a somewhat different attitude to the customer. If you assume that they're going to rob you blind, or you assume that they won't be willing to pay, I don't see how you can build a good web business.
I think that a third of a percent conversion rate, is that what you said the conversion rate was for Spotify, less than a third of a percent? That sounds about right to me. I mean, what proportion of people who hear an ad on the radio go out and buy the product? I think it's probably significantly lower than that, and yet that's been a sustainable, stable business for a long time. And what's more, Spotify has this incredible advantage, which is that if they can avail themselves of the best technology we have, which is peer-to-peer software, Spotify can run itself with virtually no infrastructure costs. I want you to imagine, those of you who are technical in the room, what would have happened if YouTube had rolled out after sockets came to Flash, and they could have implemented BitTorrent right in YouTube. They wouldn't have been spending $1 million a day on bandwidth. They never would have sold to Google. It would have been two people with no infrastructure overheads to run YouTube, right? So every kroner they took in revenue would have been a kroner in profit. They would have never had to incur any of those bandwidth charges that they're currently sitting on now. So I think that, you know, we have the opportunity to create services where the infrastructure costs are so low that the money that comes in goes a lot further. You're not burning money. How many towers did, is Axelheim here, how many towers did NRK just put up for their digital transition? Is it 3,000 digital towers?
Right. I don't know.
Something like that. Some incredible number of towers, right, with wires running to each of them, lots of power and so on. I mean, what if you could have done it all on the web for free? What if you just piggybacked on other people's services? What would it cost you to run an arcade? How much more money would you have to give to artists?
Brief rebuttal from Jana, then we're going to move on to piracy, I mean privacy.
I have a short message for I have two messages for Erik. The first one is a tweet. It's less than 140 characters. Bottled water is a product. No, isn't a product. It's a service. The other one is you are reading the wrong, or that, which means I'm not making myself clear when I talk about people's urge to pay for the product. What I'm trying to say is that if there is a legal solution which is free, I'm advocating against the solution where we legalize file sharing altogether, which makes a free legal solution. If people then would choose to pay for another solution, then you are the one who is insulting the customer, I think, not me, because then that would be stupid.
All right. I think we should talk about privacy, as I said. Anders Brenner, who's the web editor for Teknisk Ukeblad, recently said on the National Broadcasting Radio that at some point we're going to have to choose between the right to privacy and creators' rights in Norway. So I wanted to talk about how that choice looks to us now on the eve of the election and what's going to happen in the next 4 years. I'd like to start with Eirik. Do you feel that this choice is being made? And in what way do you see it going?
Some parties have already made it. And their arguments are very often misrepresented. They're sometimes called the pirate parties, which is completely wrong. Some smaller parties have. They started the debate. One large party just joined them. That's the Progress Party. They've recently come out and said, we're also in favor of privacy. I'm pretty sure that this will be a major part of the discussion going forward from here. If for no other reason, it's a very good argument. I mean, remember what we're talking about is surveillance. And it is handing over our rights to private companies like the ones Corey talked about. And that's really political meat for parties. And the ones who are in trouble at the moment are the two big parties, not only because they're unclear, but it's sort of probably because, basically, I mean, I know many people in the Conservative Party. I know the bloggers. I'm friends there. And I know that many of them aren't that keen on a surveillance society. The same with the Labour Party. I mean, there are many young people there, and there are some people who have memories of the past because the Labour Party has a past as a surveillance party. In the 70s, they used to monitor their political opponents. They don't want to be reminded of that. I don't really think that it's in the core of these two parties to be that harsh. But they're struggling now. They're trying to find a way. They really don't want to say this before the election, and they managed to stay out of the debate. But after the election, they will, sooner or later, they will have to say something. And my hunch is that that at least one of them will come down on what is looking more and more like the majority side, which is we won't go there. We won't go down the same road as the Swedes did.
John, if you had to, if you were forced to make this choice between privacy and copyright and creators' right, I mean, where do you see that balance being struck in your view?
Well, I think there are solutions already, and as I said, we have all the possibilities to look at what the other European countries are trying to do and to learn from their mistakes. And this discussion is going on in all these countries, so it's not finished at all. I think, as I said, that we first of all we need some kind of signals that this problem will be looked into. And I would say, for instance, the solution just to stop the traffic towards Pirate Bay. Now I know that Pirate Bay, the best title today, I think, was the title Pirate Bay is sinking. Not only the ship, but Pirate Bay is sinking. Think about that for some time. But I think we could stop the traffic in with the internet service providers. I think that's the best solution we have got for the moment, to give a clear signal that it's not you're not free to do anything. That's a solution that wouldn't go into any private rooms, for instance. And then we'd have to look for other solutions which would make this these solutions like April Law and Hadoopi much more flexible than it is for the moment.
Coria, would you like to respond to that? And also, I'd like to hear your opinion on what the state of that choice is in Europe.
So I'm a science fiction writer, and I write science fiction novels, so of course I'm very jealous of people who write science fiction movies, because they get paid so much more money than I do. And so one of the features in a science fiction film is that in every film with a rocket ship, someone presses the wrong button and initiates the self-destruct sequence. And it starts counting down, self-destruct in 10, 9, 8, and I think, wouldn't it be safer to design a rocket ship that wasn't intended to explode? And the second thing I think is, why didn't the engineer disconnect that the minute he got out of port? And I think that the parallel here is that if we start to design our systems so that they attack their users, so that they surveil their users, so that they can enforce policy against their users without the user's control or consent, the first thing that's going to happen is that users will take self-help measures where they're available to get around it. And you know, the idea that if we block the Pirate Bay, we'll stop infringement is, you said something about naivete earlier. Having been through the Napster wars since day one, I have to say that I find it willfully naive to believe that blocking the Pirate Bay will have any impact on piracy. I mean, what we have done since Napster is bred an ever more antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the form of ever more decentralized file-sharing systems. You know the Pirate Bay's index fits on a USB key. You know that there are 50 or 60 million copies of the Pirate Bay floating around on the internet, going online even as we speak. That it does. You have to block every IP address on the internet to block the Pirate Bay. And as soon as you did, someone would figure out how to access it via DNS or ICMP or something else. So we are. That will never ever work. But what it will do is fundamentally change the infrastructure of the network so that it attacks the users who are least capable of defending themselves, the non-savvy people, the people who aren't pirates, who aren't trying to do something naughty, who are just trying to get on with their lives. And those people will find themselves enmeshed in a network of privacy-invading, policy-enforcing technologies that they won't have the basic skills to get out from under. Meanwhile, the people who are determined to infringe will go on doing so. When I taught at the University of Southern California, my undergraduates were quite illuminating. They were all musicians, most of them, and they played music, and they would get together for big jam sessions, epic, all-day jam sessions, and they'd bring their hard drives. And while they were playing music and drinking beer, they'd synchronize several hundred gigabytes of music and video while they were making more music and video. That don't underestimate the power and capacity of a person with a thumb drive, even if the network is completely locked down. So I think that we are a couple of years away from an iPod that can hold every song ever recorded. We're maybe 5 years out from there, from a video player that can record all the commercial video ever shot. There isn't a solution that involves the network to doing this. The solution is to change the way that we manage it. In Europe, we are quite schizophrenic about this. You have the information commissioner, who's very good. We have the Spanish presidency coming up, who I think will probably be good for this, but at the same time we have the UK almost entirely in the thrall of a few entertainers, but that lobby is dissolving now that entertainers like Billy Bragg and Annie Lennox have come forward to counter this and say that they think that attacking their listeners is bad for business. So I don't know. I mean, I think that it is a detente in Europe, and no one's benefiting from it. What we aren't seeing is the development of lawful solutions that protect users from legal action and paid artists.
Okay, so brief replies from Bjarne and Bente, and then we're going to go to questions, so you can all start thinking of questions now.
Some very brief facts about Pirate Bay. In Sweden, they say, I don't know who's right, but they say that the internet traffic has gone down by 30% since the Pirate Bay conviction. And the first half year of this year, the sales of physical CDs has gone up with 37% compared to last year.
I would recommend everyone in this room to read a book called Piraterna. It's a Swedish book. It's about the Swedish piracy movement, but it's also about the history of file sharing and different kinds of technologies that has been tried to be stopped by music companies. And it's all about history repeating itself. You had Napster in 99, then you had Kazaa, and you had several other file sharing sites that have been stopped. And I think if you try to stop Pirate Bay, I think it's just, okay, let's do it again. Let's do it the same way we did before. But instead, I think we should spend the money trying to come up with creative solutions instead of spending lots of money on lawyers trying to stop Pirate Bay.
All right, first you. Please say your name.
Yeah. My name is Petter Leinochu. I'm a police officer at Lundberg. I'm involved in a lot of projects, and my question is related to that. In free software, there is a way of using copyright to create programs that everyone can use without having to fear the, what I would call the copyright mafia, that will try to stop you from sharing, stop you from tinkering, stop you from learning how things are done. All these things are important to people that are using software today. And this was created within the copyright framework by people like me that wanted to create software to scratch our own itches to make sure we could solve our problems and share our solutions with others with the same problems. And a few years ago, 10 years ago, I worked at Opera, and try to convince people there that the biggest competition for Opera, the browser, was not Microsoft, it was Firefox. Because Firefox were providing a solution for everyone that wanted it without limitations. While Opera and Microsoft provide limitations to the solution, you can't share it, well, at least you couldn't then. Opera, of course, discovered something in the intermediate years. And there is a part of this debate that's completely ignored, as far as I can see, by the panel, which is that there is a lot of content out there without limitations, where you can mix, where you can share, where you can build on it. Creative Commons, part of the Creative Commons license, allow for this. And that community working with that content is going to grow and grow and grow and grow, because they can share and build on each other, while the rest of the content will be limited and locked down, and you can't use it to create more content. So that part will shrink and shrink while the creative sharing communities will grow and grow. And shouldn't you be afraid of that community instead of pirates that's trying to take your shrinking business away? I think it was Mark, the creator of MySQL database, that said he was going to take a $20 billion industry and make it into a $1 billion industry. And that's what's happening today. Aren't you afraid of that?
Corey?
So I agree that free media is fantastic, and I use lots of it. But I also think that the problem of piracy is not merely whether or not this artist gets compensated or that artist gets compensated or this business continues or that business continues. The problem is that it is the rubric under which we are installing the tools of surveillance and control in our network, and that those tools are a much greater threat to free software than you know, Microsoft FUD campaigns. That the collaborative nature of the network that allows, for example, SourceForge to just throw up a site and not have to vet every line of code that gets checked in to make sure it doesn't infringe copyright
because they inhabit the safe harbor where they're not responsible for copyright infringement should it occur, is the reason free software exists. It's not just them, it's GitHub. It's every source control system on the net where liability doesn't live with the people who run the source control system. Now, if you take the copyright wars where they're saying, well, in fact, YouTube and anyone else who posts user-generated content has a positive obligation to review everything that comes in or face a problem of copyright infringement and be on the hook for a fraction of the damages should they be awarded, then SourceForge pops like a soap bubble. GitHub vanishes overnight. Every one of those collaborative tools stops existing. The message boards we use stop existing. Email, as we know it, stops existing. IRC stops existing. Twitter stops existing. Flickr stops existing. None of these, there aren't enough lawyer hours remaining between now and the heat death of the universe to vet every line of code checked into GitHub. And without a regime in which we recognize that infringement is not occurs, but it's not a reason to shut down collaboration, free software has no future.
Well, yeah, you asked, I mean, I guess you also asked us as creators whether we weren't afraid of the competition from free stuff. And I can assure you that I used to be. I used to say some really nasty things about Wikipedia, for instance. And the reason is that there's a difference between Corey and me, apart from him actually being a better writer, and that is he's a fiction writer, mainly. I'm a non-fiction writer. And it's definite. I can see it in my own, I can see it from my own experience, and we can see it from people's reading patterns, that non-fiction is being read on the web to a much larger degree than novels, for instance. People always say, well, you don't read a novel on the screen. Well, people read the kind of stuff I write on the screen every day. So yeah, there's competition out there. And I've seen part of my business shrink, and I've talked to kids, and I've discovered through the years, I'm always in schools and libraries, and I talk to kids, and yeah, I know, they're on the web, and they're accessing free information. Here's the thing, this is legal. We're not talking piracy here. For me, the main challenge has never been piracy. I mean, I'm not popular enough to ever have had that problem, but I'm definitely challenged. But because it's legal, and it should be, and nowadays I support it, there's not much I can do other than adapt. I mean, this is not something you can fight. You simply have to adapt. And as a result, I'm now blogging under a Creative Commons license. I'm releasing pictures under a Creative Commons license. I contribute to Wikipedia whenever I can. And I try to make a living apart from that and based on that. But it's not simple. I'm not saying that. And let's make it clear. I'm not here to sell in a brand new working business model, because it's not. It's an evolving thing. And I'm in the middle of a process, and this is a transition. But yeah, I used to be afraid. I'm not that afraid anymore.
For the record, I do write about 300,000 words of nonfiction.
I know, Corey, that you know why you're here.
All right, all the way in the back up there.
No, he was first here, so.
Hello. Hi, my name is Espen Anderson. I teach at Norway's foremost business school. I think we're, in running this debate, I think we're making a mistake of thinking that it is a political debate. And it is really a business problem. And it's the business problem of what happens to those entities that, for entirely understandable reasons, have been set up in a certain part of the value chain and now are being threatened because the distribution costs fall to zero. And this is nothing new. It's happened in many industries many times. Norsk Data was the, in 1989 was the most valuable per revenue and fastest growing computer company in the world. In 1991, they were bankrupt because they sold mini computers and the PC came. Now, I think we should sort of relax a little bit and not make it into a right versus left political campaign or say that free this or free that solves everything, because it doesn't. But I can tell you what's going to happen. What's going to happen is that we now have very powerful and very rich owners of content, such as publishers and movie studios and record companies, that are very powerful because they have a lot of money. Well, give it a few years and they don't have that much money anymore, and they don't have that much power anymore, because they're being disrupted. by digital distribution. When that happens, money flows to the parts of the value chain that are directly next to the distributors. So it's going to flow backwards, and you're going to see people make money doing the things that come before distribution, like editing and helping the creator make it better, like marketing the stuff the creator does, and by filtering the stuff on behalf of consumers. Because there is now a market for small, expensive books about poetry, and it was hard to get published. Now everybody can publish poetry, and there's a tremendous amount of really bad poetry out there. And there is a market for small websites and small publishers making selections from all those free things and publishing them so people can see. Corey runs one of the most successful on the web called One Point, which is a selector, not that much of a creator. It's a selector of what's good on the web. Okay, so that's what happens. Value is going to flow there. So I would pose that challenge to the panel. How can we move this or keep this from being a politicized campaign and thereby derail the whole campaign and stop this evolution that needs to happen? And just to point out how far it is, I teach technology strategy, and some of my students might be here. I posed a question in the beginning of the class. How many people here have pirated Microsoft Office? And, you know, that ask them how many have Microsoft Office, you know, and then take your hands down if you pay for it, right? And there are always a few people left, and I say, so why do you pirate? And he says, well, you know, it's expensive and Microsoft makes a lot of money. Yeah, I say, but you're stealing. Haven't you had a course in business ethics? And this is a business school, by the way, so the argument that they make a lot of money doesn't apply.
All right.
And that's where we need to take it, away from the politics and into the business realm. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a really great question, and we're running very short on time, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to collect two more questions, and then I'm going to ask the panel to work it into their closing statements. All the way in the back there, very briefly, please.
Thank you for an interesting speech. My name is Ragnar Bjerkheim. I am a composer. I'm the leader of all the Norwegian composers for the time being. I just want to point to a business model. I was on a conference in Copenhagen this weekend, and there was one of the biggest telephone companies in Denmark called TDC. They have done agreement with all the content of music, and they mark the works. They don't mark the listeners or the consumers. They mark all the works, and they are counting how many listenings are you doing, how many downloads are you doing, and the ESP is paying for all this. So all the customers of this ESP.
All right. So how does that work as a business model? I'm sorry.
It's working very much, and I think.
Okay. We're really short on time, so we can just skip to the question. I'm sorry. And then it was you in the back with the blue shirt. Yeah.
Me? Yeah.
Just give right to the question. Please.
Yeah. When I was very young, I read a lot. And I used to carry home big bags of books, which I read out, and I never paid for any of those. And I just read textbooks sometimes in a week. And you said here that it would be impossible to have this house of books where I could just go in and pick them up, read them, put them back, and I would never ever buy books again, or no one would buy me a book. Because we're three books available to read. And so these books that I borrowed, I could just go there and pick them up, they were paid by the state. So they were bought from the publishers, put in the house, so kids and others could just pick them up, read them, without paying ever. I don't know if you ever encountered this problem, what you want to do with it.
All right, so we have two competing business models here. I'm going to ask you to give a 1 minute closing statement, and I'm going to be very, very strict with the time this time. So, and you can incorporate the questions into your closing statements. Bjarne.
Okay, then I'll just tie it up by saying something about the business question. I think somehow it's a question of business model, but not for the companies, but for the artists. You said that what's going to happen is that we will see more of in the publishing houses of editing and marketing. What do you think publishers have done up to now? We have done editing and marketing, so this is not
really
new.
Bad at marketing.
This is not new. We need to keep these mechanisms for the writers. I don't care if the publishers or the music companies don't survive. I think I'm interested in this question because I don't think artists can survive without somebody doing this job for them. If they had to do all this instead of creating, the artwork we would get out would be much poorer than what we get today.
My last remark is that I want to see more experimentation when it comes to different kind of business models. I think we need to test out different ways of doing this, because if the only solution is going to be to stop Pirate Bay, I think we're just going to continue the same track. And one thing I think is very, very important is to avoid going in this three strikes approach. I think if we do that, then we're going to have the kind of society that Tore has described in his book. So we have to be much more creative than that.
I was very encouraged by the last two speakers, because it wasn't really a question. I agree with Mr. Bjerknam, who talked about the Danish ISP solution. That's a good solution, and that is probably part of what we are going to do in Norway. But to go there, we need some sort of consensus. And to get that consensus, we need some sort of political clarification, which means that the two parties I mentioned needs to do something. They need to get off their behinds and take a stand. As for the library, you're completely right. I love the library. The library is a brilliant idea. But as you said, it's government funded. And in addition to the government buying books for the library, we also have library compensation. Writers get compensated for the loss of sales that they incur through the library, which I think is a good idea. And the library compensation is actually part of what I'm suggesting when I say, we've done this before. We know how to do this. We have a free model. We pay the artists to distribute to the free model. It can work.
So if you walk into a nightclub here in Oslo and you hear a DJ playing music, that DJ doesn't pick up the phone every time he drops the needle and call up a record executive and say, I'm going to play 30 seconds of this and then 45 seconds of that. How much is my license? He pays a performing rights organization for the right to play that. Same with the radio. Now, he doesn't have to. Right? If the DJ writes his own compositions, he can perform his own compositions, or he can perform the compositions of his friends without paying a PRO. And that works great. Is there anyone here who works for an internet service provider? All right, so if I said to you, you can offer to your customers the service of, for an extra 5 kroner a month, they can download all the music ever recorded for free legally.
Sold.
You don't have to force the ISPs. We can just offer them the same deal that every radio station, every nightclub, every restaurant, every elevator, every doctor's office, every kindergarten classroom has enjoyed for decades. And what this saves us is demonizing our users, telling them that what they want is wrong, and it saves us also the incredibly awkward position of excoriating librarians, because you can never win by excoriating librarians. There is no trade in our society that has more moral authority than those who are the guardians and distributors of human of all human knowledge and cultural preservation. And I can see librarians. There are two groups of librarian. And if you put yourself in a position where you can only succeed by harming one of those two groups, you will lose. So I think there's our answer, right? There's a business model that works. Offer ISPs the license that everyone else gets. Let the ISPs offer it to their customers. Everybody gets paid. No one's a thief. We don't have to surveil everyone. We're done.
My mother is a librarian, and that's absolutely true. Thank you so much to the panel. It's been a wonderful debate. Ronald, would you like to say something?
Thank you ever so much to the panel, thank you for spending the election evening here. And right afterwards, Corey Doctor will be signing the book in the bookstore. So if you want to grab a copy, it's not.